I'm going to begin tonight with a question. You don't need to answer it because I'm going to answer it. But the question that I'm going to put before you tonight is this. How do you get from a man having a theological epiphany to a Reformed church? Right? How do you get from this one guy having an understanding of something new to a church that breaks away from the Western church to become another branch of Christianity? How do you get there? All right, well, tonight what I want to do is to start to answer that question by moving beyond our biography of Luther now to the reality of Luther's theology. Luther came to understand some new things, but his understanding was not limited to just to him. And so the question then becomes is, how does it go from him out from him to where does it go? Where does it go out from there and so forth? And so we're really the beginnings of the Reformation, we could call this, but I preferred rather to call it the reality of Luther's theology, because I want to look at two different aspects of Luther's theology. One is its immediate political and social effects, and then we'll look at what that theology actually is. Gonzalez has an entire chapter in his book on Luther's theology. What sets it apart? What makes you unique and different? Because justification by faith is only the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more to consider. So I want to look at both sides, the effect of that theology upon the time in which Luther lived, and then moving out from there, what is it he believed that then went out from there to the rest of the world? How did it move out from that particular place? So let's rethink, or let me recapitulate a little bit about Luther then, and we'll move into the subject. Luther, you remember, had a very strict upbringing that led him to a place where he came into deep spiritual turmoil regarding his own sin, particularly in comparison to the holiness of God, which he thought was absolute. And so he sees himself as this dead sinner against this holiness of God. It caused great consternation within him. And this is all, of course, inside of the medieval church's teaching of justification by the infused process of keeping the various commands the church gives you. All right, so here's a man being told, do all these things and you'll be right with God. He does all these things. He doesn't feel right with God. So he comes to a conversion. Now, he's always been a believer, in a sense, at least as far as medieval Christians could be. But he has a moment in which he understands something specifically from Scripture when he comes to that phrase, the righteousness of God, Romans chapter 1. And up until this point in his life, he's always understood that to mean the very nature of God's holiness, the nature of God's holiness such that he is just. And he comes to realize that, no, that phrase is actually what is given to the believer, imputed to the believer by faith in Christ. The righteousness of God is something given to us and made in such that we are made just when we trust in Christ. And that was, of course, a watershed moment for him to come to that realization that, yes, God is fully righteous in every sense, but he has given that righteousness, imputed that righteousness to the believer. Now, that leads him, of course, to a confrontation. That confrontation comes out of two sets of theses that he writes, published to teach his new view of justification. He wanted to make an argument in the academy to this so that others in the academy would come to understand this and thus it would get taught. But this came into direct conflict with the Pope selling indulgences, Leo X selling indulgences through men like John Tetzel to build St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, and obviously Luther's new view of justification ran headlong into that situation. And so that led eventually to Luther's condemnation. Although he was protected by the nobility in the area, specifically Frederick the Wise, he was dragged before several conclaves, including his own Augustinian order, a couple of different other meetings, but ultimately he found himself condemned at the Diet of Worms, only to be then protected at the castle at Wartburg. Now that's where we left off in our examination of Luther last week. Luther is in the castle at Wartburg. He will be there for 10 months, being protected by Frederick the Wise. But it's this particular moment where things begin to come together. the rise of the Reformation Church out of Luther. So we're going to look at two things, as I mentioned before. First, a discussion of some of the immediate effects of his thinking in Germany and beyond. Effects in Germany and beyond. And then secondly, next week, Lord willing, we're going to come to an overview of where Luther's theology went following his new view of justification and what that would mean for the larger church beyond. Now, let me just give you a caveat up front. The details that I'm about to give you may seem to you overwhelming and potentially irrelevant, but they are essential for us to understand how some things came into being. And along the way, I'm going to point out some specific things that came into being that you are familiar with, but may not have known their genesis. And it is into this time frame that I want to point that out to you. So these details, yep, I'm going to throw a lot of details at you over the next 50 minutes or so, but that's going to be essential because we're going to be needing that to understand what's about to happen. So let's talk about the effects of Luther's theology. Let's start with the effects at Wittenberg, okay, where Luther was from. Now, Luther's not there at the moment, right? He's in the castle at Wartburg, but there's some things going on at Wittenberg while he's away. You remember that Luther had successfully won a number of his colleagues over to his new view of justification. He had been successful in getting a number of those in Wittenberg there in the school and in the church there to come to his position. And a number of other theological positions that he had come to were beginning to be embraced by those in the academy and in the church at Wittenberg. Now, we'll talk more about the details of the theology in our next lesson. This begins then to have real-world effects upon the spiritual and ecclesiastical thinking and actions in Wittenberg. People who no longer see justification as a process, but rather see it as a simple imputation by faith, will now begin to apply that thinking to every other aspect of their lives. It is inevitable. If you believe, up until now, that your justification is a process, your entire life is going to be built around that process. But if you come to believe that the process is irrelevant, then your entire life is going to change. It's a necessary side effect of this. That's going to include the church, the home, society, politics, and economics are all going to be affected by a new view of justification. Now, let me also note something. In the time that Luther was at Wittenberg, during the days when he, between the time he had come to his new understanding of justification and the time he had gone to the Diet of Worms, it's a period of time, while he's there at Wittenberg, he did not make any significant changes to the life of the church that he was leading in that place. He did not. He did not attempt to make whole-scale reformation in Wittenberg at the time. And there's two reasons that he admits for that. Number one, he had a significant fear of making substantial changes because he recognized still, remember, he's a man of his time, he recognized that the church that he was a part of was instituted by God. You don't go making whole-scale changes to that which God has instituted without stopping to think about it for a bit. And remember, as a man of his time, he is very much a part of a church that he has known nothing else of than that. Secondly, Luther himself admits that he wasn't quite sure how to take his new theological positions, particularly on justification by faith and some of the others, and implement them. What exactly should I do and should I not do in attempting to implement these things? But there were others who were not so cautious. And so, while Luther was away at Wartburg, some of his colleagues began to make changes. Karlstadt, Andreas Karlstadt, I mentioned his name last week. He was the one who was called to the debate at Leipzig. Remember, he was the one that Eck decided to attack Luther's thinking by going after Karlstadt instead of going after Luther. Instead of breaking the truce that had been established between Luther and the Pope, Eck decided, well, I'll just attack one of the other members of the academy. Well, it's Karlstadt who was the other guy. Well, Karlstadt, while Luther is up in Wartburg, began to make some changes. He, for example, went to the local church and started removing all the images of saints from the church. Another gentleman by the name of Gabriel Zwilling, who was an Augustinian monk, began to preach fiery sermons to stir up the people. In fact, their preaching was very effective. It began to have real consequences when they started preaching these ideas of justification by faith and the fact that salvation is no longer a process but rather an imputation, and there's a whole lot of other ramifications to that. They started to preach these sermons, and it began to have real consequences in the city. For example, there were a number of monks and nuns who left their monasteries and their convents to get married. It was against the law, but they did it anyways. I want you to remember that thought, okay? A number of nuns left the convent to get married. I'll come back to that in a minute. The Mass, the worship service of the Catholic Church in that day, was simplified, and German was substituted for Latin. Mass was in Latin. The people didn't really understand the language that the priests were using. It was mystical, but priests were now starting to use German in the Mass rather than Latin. That's what you call preaching in the vernacular. You want to hear something really ironic? Just as an aside here for a second. Vatican II ordered the churches to move away from Latin to the vernacular. Vatican II, which was in the 1960s, ordered the church to move away from Latin for the Mass to be done in the common language of the people. Okay, so what you have is, fast forward to the 1960s, the church in Vatican II orders now that the Mass be done in the language of the people. I grew up, by the way, in the 1960s and 70s, of course, and so I only knew the Mass in the vernacular. I only knew it in English. I very rarely ever went to a Latin Mass because Vatican II had basically outlawed the Mass in Latin. Well, there was a whole lot of pre-Vatican folk who wanted the Mass still in Latin, and for a very long time they had petitioned for the Vatican to allow them to do that, and there was some give and take on that. Not too long ago, Benedict XVI issued an apologetic in which he allowed the churches, the local bishops, to make a decision as to whether they would have the Mass in Latin or not, gave them the authority to do that. Pope Francis, a couple of weeks ago, issued a statement that that can no longer be done. The Mass must be done in the vernacular. He overturned Benedict's edict and put the Mass back in the vernacular. Now, I find that unbelievably ironic because here we are at a time in the 16th century when the only Mass was in Latin. The reformers are the ones who put it back in the vernacular. The church carries on with it in Latin until the 1960s when they push it back into the vernacular, and the attempt to go back is rebuffed by the Pope. God has a sense of humor. Masses for the dead were abolished. Makes sense. There's no purgatory. There's no reason to do masses for the dead. Okay. Along with various fasting days and days of abstinence and other kinds of things are all done away with. Many were done away with. And then another gentleman by the name of Philip Melanchthon. I always have a hard time saying his name. Melanchthon, who was another voice in the reforming efforts at Wittenberg and later, began to offer in communion both the bread and the cup. Now, I might have mentioned this several weeks ago, but at this particular point in Catholicism, when you took the took communion, you were only offered the host. You were not offered the wine. Now, what's ironical about that is I can count on one hand, I think, the number of times that I ever took both elements of communion when I was growing up. The cup was never offered. So this particular man said, look, if you're going to offer the elements to the people, offer both elements, the body and blood of Christ. Notice it's reformers to the church that are doing this sort of thing. So Back in Wittenberg, while Luther is there at Wartburg, some of his contemporaries in that place are beginning to make some changes there in the city and around the church. Luther initially supported these changes, but he began to question some of the excesses of the changes that were being made. Remember I said a minute ago that he struggled with making changes to something that had been ordained by God, and so he's like, well, how far should we go with this? Can we keep this and get rid of this and so forth? This, by the way, would dog Luther all of his life. In fact, eventually, in a couple of weeks, we're going to talk about a man by the name of Ulrich Zwingli. Zwingli is going to look Luther in the face and say to him, if you're going to be reformed, be reformed. Stop being halfway. We, by the way, as Baptists, will trace much of our lineage from Zwingli. Okay? If you're going to be reformed, be reformed. Luther struggled with this, and particularly various excesses. The particular example that comes to mind that most historians note is this. While Luther is at Wartburg, three men from a place called Zwickau, which was nearby, came to Wittenberg, and they began to claim that God spoke directly to them. And they could decide matters of theology and ecclesiology without the need for Scripture. They could receive a direct word from God. Okay, now, again, is this not often a side effect of Reformation? One of the extremes, of course, is this idea that, well, you know what? God just spoke to me, and so I think we should go and do this and do that and tear down this and tear down that, build this and build that, because, well, God just said we should. Luther, of course, saw this as a tremendous excess. And Melanchthon appealed to Luther at Wartburg about how to handle it. What do we do with these three guys? Okay. This is what caused Luther to leave the castle and go back to Wittenberg. He notified Frederick that he was leaving. Again, he appealed to Frederick to support him and protect him as he went back. And he hoped that he would, but ultimately he did not count on Frederick, but on the hand of God over him. In his memoirs, he writes that he went back to Wittenberg because what was taking place there distressed him so much that he felt it was necessary to go, even if it meant his own death. And so he went back. He returned to Wittenberg on March the 6th of 1521. He traveled disguised as an Augustinian hermit. When he got to the city, he preached at the city church there 8 sermons, which he used to help calm down the situation, to help sort of relax the situation. He admonished some of the reformers, these men I've just mentioned, for their lack of Christian love, not helping the weak to understand and come along in the process. You know, just using the bull in a china shop approach is, we're just going to dump everything out, and if you don't understand, well, that's your problem. And he said, that's not really showing good Christian charity to people. We need to be more careful about how we do that sort of thing. He warned against the use of force. He was particularly concerned that there would be men who would attempt to implement Reformation by violence. And he didn't want that. Now, we're going to see that become an issue as we continue on in our discussion tonight. He maintained that only the preaching of the gospel and the persuasion of the hearts and minds of men should be used to effect Reformation. He wasn't interested in using political or economic or social methodologies to cause Reformation, but he felt that the best way to reform the church was to preach the gospel and persuade men that the gospel was true, that the scriptures were true, and let them make Reformation take place. This becomes a fundamental reality, by the way, of Reformed theology. There are many who want to use more direct approaches to Reformation, you know, just come in and beat people until they give in. But Luther was, no, we convince, we preach, because if our gospel is true, if this is in fact what God has ordained into the world, then the Spirit of God will use it to accomplish the reformation of the church. We don't need to implement methodologies to accomplish it. Let's just persuade. Let's preach and teach. And he also preached that many of the non-essentials should be left to the individual conscience. A lot of the non-essential things having to do with this gospel, like whether or not clergy should be married, whether they should be There should be a monastic movement, if people should have certain days in which they fast and certain days in which they don't, and all the various days of obligation that the church has and so forth. That should be left to the conscience of individual people. And that's utterly biblical, of course, and right. In other words, what Luther came back to Wittenberg to do, and I think he was effective at it, is he sought to find the proper means to produce reformation. Through persuasion of the truth of the gospel, which brings about true conversion, and not through force or zeal or the power of law. Attempting to make people into a certain image by enforcing it over them by law does not work. Never has. Persuade, preach, teach, disciple. Guess what happens? People begin to see, yeah, I can connect that teaching to that idea in the church. They begin to see it. It's an old method, by the way, of pastoral leadership. You don't come with the ideas. You wait for the people to get the ideas and come to you. But you plant the seeds of those ideas in various ways until they get it. And then they stand up and say, but pastor, we really need this to happen. And the pastor sits back and goes, yeah, I know. I've been wanting you to do that for a long time. That's a much better approach than the bull in the china shop approach, where you come in and just say, look, we're going to do this, and you're going to come along for the ride. And what do you get? You get rebellion. So Luther came trying to balance, if you will, how to bring true reformation to the church without the more fringe elements, the cage stage reformers, taking over and ruling the day. Now, let me just throw in a little side note right about here. The events that I'm about to describe actually come much, much later in Luther's life, but there's a connection to what I just talked about here. Okay? Luther eventually marries a former nun. Okay? Remember I said a minute ago that there were some nuns who decided they didn't want to be nuns anymore, they wanted to go and be married. I had an aunt, by the way, one of my father's sister, who went to a convent, joined the convent when she was 17, 18 years old, stayed there for a couple of years, left the convent, got married, had 5 sons. I'm familiar with this idea of a nun not staying as a nun. This was one of the side effects of this reforming zeal that was taking place. There was a group of nuns in a nearby convent who had been spurred on by this new thinking in Wittenberg. They sent word to Luther that they were convinced and sought his help in leaving the nunnery. So he helped arrange for their escape. He actually helped, and he found himself in a position of now needing to provide for them. You have a bunch of women who do not have husbands. They don't, in that patriarchal society, what's their chances? So Luther, at that point, in agreeing to help them out of the nunnery, now agrees that he's got to help them to either find a place to live, meaning put these women someplace into a house where they can be useful there, or find them a husband. One of the nuns, a woman by the name of Katerina von Bora, refused to marry the suitors that Luther had arranged for her. Instead, she set her eyes on him. Luther's friends, in fact, suggested that he marry her. He first joked about it, and then he later said, well, I'm not really sure I should get married because I suspect I'm going to be a martyr pretty soon. I mean, after all, I'm the guy they're chasing around the countryside, right? And so he felt like, I'm not so sure that I ought to get married. But he eventually agreed, and they were married. They seemed to have a happy marriage. There are books written by people who have biographied Katrina, the wife of Luther. And they apparently did seem to have a happy marriage. It was particularly one filled with humor. Apparently, Luther had a wicked, sarcastic sense of humor. He called his wife, my Lord Katrina, and she complained that he was a slob. Most of you women probably would say that, right? They had 6 children, 6 surviving children, and also cared for a number of orphans and students. In fact, Luther often called his family a small church. Out of his family life came something published called the Table Talks, in which he would sit around at the kitchen table with some of his students and have conversations about things. And his students compiled these Table Talks as a series of conversations. They're still available today. You can Google them and read them. They're fascinating. There was a rumor that Luther would sit with a cigar and talk with his friends about theology, and that became known as the Table Talks. There are some who suggest that the manner that Luther educated his children has been cited as the forerunner to public education. I would argue that it's probably the forerunner to homeschooling more than to public education, but nonetheless, he had a very strict view of how to raise his children and raise them. Now, where do you think he got that from? Maybe from his own upbringing. The acorn doesn't fall too far from the tree, you know. And so it's very possible that he instilled a certain strictness to the education of his children because he understood how important it was coming out of his own background. You will notice, I give you that as an example, him marrying Katrina, because it's a side effect of the Reformation. In a sense, you've got women who up until this point would never have considered leaving the nunnery because, well, frankly, it was against the law. And once you made a commitment to the nunnery, you're in it for the rest of your life. That's it. The only way out, by the way, was suicide. So once the thinking processes begin to bubble in Wittenberg and some of these women start thinking, wait a minute. If I'm thinking differently about my theology, then there's some practical ramifications to that. And one is that I don't have to stay here. And I don't have to be celibate for the rest of my life. I can marry and have children and do these sorts of things. So you'll notice that even Luther himself is affected by his own thinking process in the real world. The real world starts to crowd in even on the man himself. Even as he's preaching against the excesses and trying to find compromise in Wittenberg between a bull in a china shop approach to Reformation and then on the other side, you know, not doing anything at all, he himself is being affected by it, even in marrying this woman. Now, to add to that then, however, we need to talk about, and this is where it kind of gets difficult, we need to talk about some of the socioeconomic revolts that take place. I'm going to give you a very quick summary of the political realities surrounding Charles V. Now, you remember him. He is the king of Germany, establishes the emperor, the king of the Holy Roman Emperor. Remember, he was the one who was elected to this position after Maximilian had died. And you remember Pope Leo wanted Frederick to be the guy to be elected, but ultimately Charles I of Spain was elected to the role of this new position, now taking the name Charles V. Charles V, after the Diet of Worms, remember it is Charles V who issues the decree against Luther at Worms, after Worms was determined to stamp out the Lutheran heresy in Germany. But a number of political realities got in the way. Now, I started into this a little bit last week, but let me flesh it out a little bit more. Charles had constant struggle with Francis I of France. He was the other guy that was the possible emperor of Germany to be elected to the position to the Holy Roman Empire, if you will. And so there was constant friction between Germany and France. Francis I was constantly declaring war on Charles V. Leo X, the Pope, who was building St. Peter's, you remember, died just a few months before the Diet of Worms was called. So Leo X was dead at the Diet of Worms. And so Charles V appointed a man, his friend, a man by the name of Adrian, got him elected to the papacy. He took the title of Adrian VI. Adrian VI, by the way, was the last non-Italian pope until John Paul II. So every pope from Adrian VI in the early part of the 16th century until the 20th century was from Italy. John Paul II broke that streak Francis is also non-Italian. He's from Argentina. Adrian tried to implement a series of reforms, quote-unquote, in the church in order to steal the thunder from Luther. Figured if I implement a few changes, you know, fix a few ecclesiastical offices, get a little corruption here, a little corruption there, maybe I can steal Luther's thunder and basically cut the rug out from under him, and it'll put an end to this Reformation that's starting to take hold. Well, that didn't work because Adrian died just a year and a half in to his papacy, and the next pope that followed behind him, Clement VII, returned to Leo X's policies and, with Francis I of France, declared war on Charles. A whole lot of political intrigue behind all of that, but eventually comes down to Charles V's armies invade and sack the city of Rome. The pope has to flee. His forces are then repelled from Rome by a plague, and all kinds of other issues involving Francis and Clement and blah, blah, blah. Too much detail that really matters here. And additionally, not only is Charles VI having to deal with the realities in his own native land of Lutheranism breaking out, having to deal with Francis in France, having to deal with Clement down in Rome, he also has to deal with the Turks on his eastern front, who are now rising up through a man by the name of Suleiman to take over Western Europe. And so he's forced to send his forces to the east to repel the invaders from Turkey coming at him. So he's literally being attacked on three sides. France to the west, Francis to the west, Clement to the south, the Turks to the east. The only reason he's not being attacked to the north, there's nothing north of Germany except the Arctic Circle, and whoever's living up there doesn't care. So he's got a real serious problem on his hands. Now, I put all that in front of you. Just think about that for a second. The guy who's running Germany at the time, the emperor who issued his edict against Luther, is not able to make it stick because he's too busy with all the other political realities going on around him. So, while he is away, there are two major revolts that take place in Western Europe. Again, let me remind you of something. This is not a time of financial or economic ease. It is a time of great difficulty. Plague and famine are common in these days. There are two primary revolts that come up which have everything to do with the Reformation. Okay, so bear with me. The first is the Knights Revolt, which takes place in 1522 and 23. The knightly class of nobility had seen its fortunes decline for some time, and they rebelled against Charles. There were a number of other, there were a couple of other knightly revolts, but this is the big one. They saw their struggle in this class as a defense of the Reformation. Luther had not encouraged them. He had not in any way suggested to them they should rebel against the nobility above them. But they took it upon themselves to make their cause a cause of reformation. They were defeated soundly by the other German nobility, the German princes. And Luther simply saw this as an unwarranted challenge to authority. He saw the knights rising up against the authority in much the same way that I talked about before. You are attempting to use a bull in a china shop approach against people who have authority over you, and they bear the sword. And if they do, and you rebel, then the consequences are yours to bear. You may call it a Reformation fight, but you are not attempting to reform the church. You're only attempting to reform your own socioeconomic position. That's very different. So Luther did not see the Knight Revolt as a part of the Reformation per se. He stood back against it. Some commentators have suggested that this was Luther's finest hour. In terms of his relationship to the political world, Luther said, "What are you doing? All you're going to do is get yourself killed. That's not how we're going to succeed at this. We're not going to succeed at this with bloodshed." But that leads to a second revolt that takes place, and this is called the Peasant Rebellion, and it occurs the next year in 1524. Now, the knightly class had certainly been suffering, but the peasant class had been suffering much, much more. Obviously, the ordinary peasants living in the times during the days of famine and plague would be seriously struggling. And they had long suffered such economic conditions. In fact, they had rebelled at least six times prior to this against the empire. They believed that the teachings of the reformers now supported their economic demands. Much like the knightly class before them, they came to believe that, yes, if the church needs reforming, the empire needs reforming. If the financial realities of the empire, the financial realities of the empire mirror that of the church, the church is corrupt, the empire is corrupt, we are poor because all the people at the top have all the money. They didn't invent the idea of the 1%, but hey, they're way ahead of it, right? Okay, so they see their struggle in very much the same way that the teachings of the reformers supported their economic demands. There was a young man by the name of Thomas Munzer, also of Zwickau. Remember that place where the three men came preaching that they didn't need the Bible, the Spirit could just come and teach them? Okay, he came from the same place. And he came preaching that the Spirit, outside of Scripture, was leading the peasants to establish a theocratic community to usher in the kingdom of God. What are they arguing? We need to overthrow the empire. We need to overthrow the king. We need to overthrow the nobility, all the nobility above it, and establish a theocratic world where such men do not rule over us. And they developed a document called the 12 Articles, in which they made a number of economic and religious demands, which Luther was unprepared to address. Luther had been toying and developing his doctrine of the two kingdoms. But at this particular point, it's not fully fleshed out yet. We'll talk about the doctrine of the two kingdoms when we talk about its theology in our next lesson. But suffice it to say, Luther is trying to figure out how to balance the fact that human beings belong to two different kingdoms. I should say, the elect belong to two different kingdoms. Because the elect belong to, first, the kingdom of the earth upon which they are stationed. We are Americans. We belong in America. But we also belong to a higher kingdom, which is the kingdom of God, which is being established slowly in the world. Therefore, we have our feet in two worlds. There's got to be some way to figure out how to balance that. How do we live in this world and yet be a part of that particular kingdom? Luther was unprepared to deal with this, and he tried to straddle the fence. He addressed the princes, the nobility of the time, and he told them that the peasants' demands were just. They had a right to stand up and say, look, we're being treated unfairly, we're being treated poorly. You know, you people at the top are keeping all of the wealth to yourself. You're not trickling it down to us, and we're the ones suffering down here. Luther wrote to the princes and told them that their cause was just. But at the same time, he tried to persuade the peasants not to take up arms. Again, what's his point? Same one that he had with the knightly rebellion. It isn't going to work if you're going to try to go and attack the nobility to try to resolve the issue. Violence doesn't solve the problem. So he tried to straddle the fence. In the end, Luther actually called upon the princes to suppress the movement. As I said a minute ago, the knightly rebellion was probably his finest hour. This is probably his worst. This is probably the moment in his life where he made the biggest mistake. He tried to convince the princes to suppress the movement, but to do it peacefully, to do it in a way that would not be bloodshed, but the result was a bloodbath. More than 100,000 peasants were killed in this rebellion. Even though Luther urged the princes to be merciful, they saw themselves as the nobility, they saw themselves as the authority, and they wielded the sword against the peasants and killed many of them. Now, I put those things in front of you, even though they involve Luther, but they have a larger purpose. The consequences of these two revolts are this. Catholic princes, the Catholic nobility, now blames Lutheranism for the revolt. Why did these peasants rise up? Why did these knights rise up? Because they were embracing Luther's theology. Because they were embracing this idea of radical reformation. It's Luther's fault. And the split between the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church became more radical. The flip side of that is the peasants that survived the peasant uprising, vast numbers of them blamed Luther for betraying them and abandoned the new faith, or became even more radical. And the more radical movement became known as the Anabaptist movement. Now, we'll talk more about that later because it doesn't really come to fruit for another 50 years or so. But it starts, if you will, here. Now, the events that I summarized above regarding Charles V and the Peasant Revolt and the Knight Revolt occur between 1521 and 1530. How long is that? 9 years. Less than a decade. Between the point where Charles V abandoned the country to go fight with Francis and then have to deal with Clement, then have to deal with the Turks, and 1530, when he finally returned from his fighting with the Turks, these events took place. A decade. In the meantime, while Charles is gone, the country has to be ruled by somebody. And so that somebody is the nobility. Now, you remember that the nobility is made up of men with authority and land holdings and so forth. And so they're able to come together on a regular basis and make decisions about the life of the nation. We call those conclaves diets. The Diet of Worms was one of those conclaves where the nobility comes together to make decisions, in this particular case having to do with Luther, all right? So there are a number of these political conclaves that take place between 1521 and 1530. In 1523, there was a diet called at Nuremberg, and that diet adopted a policy of tolerance towards Lutheranism. Now, you will notice this is before the peasant revolt. This is before the knightly revolt. They issue a policy of tolerance toward Lutheranism. Now, the primary reason for that is because with Charles V out of the country and his armed forces having to deal with foreign enemies, there's nobody to go out and enforce it. Who's going to go out and enforce this rule over every little town throughout Germany that might be espousing some Lutheran doctrine in their church? So their priest is starting to preach some sort of Lutheran doctrine. Who's going to go and enforce it? Well, there's nobody. So they realized the best thing to do is to adopt a policy of toleration towards it. Then in 1526, which is now after these revolts, at a place called Speyer, the Diet formally withdrew the Edict of Worms and granted the German states the freedom to choose its own religious alliance. Much of Austria and the south of Germany went Catholic. Other areas began implementing Lutheranism as they saw fit. Why? Answer, most likely, is because the bloodshed during these revolts brought to the realization of these nobles, we're going to have to find some compromise with these folks. They're simply not going to go away. And so they officially remove the Edict of Worms. So now Luther finds himself in a position where he's no longer under indictment. He's no longer indicted as a heretic because they removed the edict. But in 1529, again at Speyer, led probably by a different class of nobility at this point, the Diet formally, the Second Diet, reaffirmed the Edict of Worms. They went back on their promise from 1526, just 3 years earlier, that the edict issued at the Diet of Worms by Charles V would not be enforced, that it would be removed, but now they've reaffirmed it. And it's from pressure of Charles. Charles threatens the Diet. If you don't solve this, I'm coming back. And if I come back and bring in the troops with me and the first ones get their heads chopped off, it's going to be you guys. So put this back in place. And they did. Remember, it was Charles who declared the original edict against Luther at Worms. And he remained stubbornly opposed to Luther as a heretic of the church. But he had been preoccupied with political realities for the past eight years. Now those issues are being resolved. He finds himself having driven back the Turks. France has been put where he needs to be. In fact, for a time he imprisoned Francis and then released him, and they've had a detente for a while. He finally got over his issues with the Pope, and now it's time to come home. So what does he do? He threatens the nobility. I'm coming back, and I want that Lutheran guy and all he believes stamped out of Germany. Now, this switch from removing the edict to putting the edict back prompted the Lutheran princes of the Diet, the Lutheran nobility, to present a formal protest against the newly revived edict. Thus, they became known as Protestants. They became known as Protestants. They protested the idea of the edict being overturned, or restored, I should say, that had been overturned. Now, I bring that up, as I said at the top of this, all this detail is like, okay, who cares? But you will notice I just gave you a word you're familiar with. All right? How many of you really knew that the genesis of that word comes from the various diets dealing with the Edict of Worms? Probably very few. I would bet less than a handful of Christians in the world really know that to be the case. See, the title has often been applied generally to the Reformed branch of Christianity, right? We call ourselves Protestants. But the term itself has a more specific genesis and intention. It was a protest against the revival of a statement condemning Luther and Lutheranism in Germany. So the Protestants were originally men who protested against what had been granted to them and now was being taken away in that edict. Now, I will grant you that we can use the term Protestant to describe ourselves. We're probably better to call ourselves Reformed Christians rather than Protestants, because if we're going to be more technical. But we can use this term to describe ourselves because over time, the new view of justification by Luther eventually sweeps through his entire theological framework next week. The effect becomes real as those embracing his theology attempt to put it into practice. And this becomes, for us, a de facto protestation against what the church has been believing all along. In fact, most Christians probably believe that the reason we're called Protestants is because we're protesting the Catholic Church, right? But there's no protestation against the Catholic Church in any of what I just described. They're protesting the nobility. But nonetheless, it is fair to say that we, in the Reformed branch of Christianity in the West, can say, yeah, we protest against what Catholicism teaches. We're not embracing it. We're protesting against it. But I want you to understand where the term actually comes from, because that's part of the process of understanding what these terms really meant when they originally came and how they're now being used, which they may not be consistent with how they originally intended. And by the way, that's true of a whole bunch of other words in our vocabulary, okay? Some of which we'll get to even in our theological discussions. So, in 1529, at Speyer, the Second Diet reaffirmed the Edict of Worms, and there was a protest backlash. So, in 1530, at a place called Augsburg, the Diet gathered to hear an orderly exposition of the points at issue. Who called it? Charles called it. He was back. Now, you remember, this was contrary to Charles's view at Worms. At Worms, he just looked at Luther and said, you recant. I don't care what your arguments are. Just recant. But now he wants to hear an orderly exposition of what this Lutheran theology is. And I would argue the reason for it is because it's spreading like wildfire. So somebody's got to write down, what is it that you people believe? I mean, Luther could come in and say, well, I believe that justification is by faith. Okay, that's simple. But now there's all kinds of other stuff that's coming out of it. kinds of thinking coming out of it. Again, we'll look at the details of that next week. And so Charles says, give me a detailed examination of it. And so that guy I mentioned earlier, Philip Melanchthon, outlined the main points of Lutheran theology in contrast to Catholic teaching, which became known as the Augsburg Confession. The Augsburg Confession, written in 1530, is the first great Protestant confession and became the basis for Lutheran orthodoxy. Lutheranism today embraces the Augsburg Confession as its fundamental confession of faith. There are later confessions, of course, that are written by other groups to outline their specific versions of orthodoxy. You have the Belgic Confession in 1561, the Westminster Confession by the Presbyterians in 1647, the Baptist and Second Baptist Confessions in 1644 and 1689, the Philadelphia Baptist Confession in 1742, written in America, the Baptist Faith and Message of the Southern Baptist Convention, written in 1925 and updated in 1963 and 2000, are all confessions of faith that have been written down through the centuries to describe what that particular group considers orthodoxy. When the various signatories of the Augsburg Confession refused to abandon their faith, Charles, once again being the lenient guy that he was, gave them 1 year, until April of 1531, to recant. Now, Charles was a wealthy man and greatly powerful, right? That's how he got into the position of the monarchy to begin with, and the reason why he survived all of these various kinds of things is he had massive landholdings, and he had massive monies and massive troops, and he could have easily have mustered them against the Lutheran princes and defeated them and ended Protestantism overnight. He quite literally could have shut the Reformation down. He had the power to do that. So the Protestant princes came together to create a common front. And Luther agreed that it was legal for them this time to take up arms in self-defense. Notice this was not an offensive, a self-defensive move that Luther considered to be legal. There was a long war anticipated in Germany between the nobility under Charles fighting against Lutheranism and lots of peasants and ordinary folks fighting on the other side. But in the providence of God, Charles was forced again to postpone his action because Francis of France came back to life and the Turks were back to avenge their previous defeat. He was pulled away again to fight the foreign enemies. So, the Protestants and the Catholics of the nobility agreed to something called the Peace of Nuremberg, 1532. They agreed that they would come together as a common force to help Charles in his support or in his defense of the nation if they would both be allowed to practice their faith as they deemed appropriate. The Protestants to practice Lutheranism according to the Augsburg Confession, the Catholics to continue doing what they've been doing for 1,500 years. The only stipulation that was placed upon the Lutherans is that they would not attempt to extend their view of Lutheranism beyond the borders of Germany or beyond their territories, which they didn't, except a lot of other people did. The Peace of Nuremberg was short-lived. Now, let me just remind you of something as we close. All of the above occurs roughly between 1521 and 1532. 10 years. 10 years from the Diet of Worms, when Luther is condemned as a heretic, to the point where Charles V comes back and threatens to have Lutheranism undone, and you get eventually you get a confession and an official Lutheranism, and then a peace treaty made between them. About 10 years of time. It is this decade in which the Reformation is solidified. By the end of that 10 years, the Reformation is now firmly in place, and it cannot be stopped. That's why I wanted you to see this 10 years. I want you to see what happened during his 10 years. I want you to see those revolts that Luther had to deal with and the various kinds of things that were taking place in Wittenberg, because you need to see that in this little short window of time, just 10 years in the whole history of the church, a whole new branch of Christianity is born and given life. And on it goes. And it will not stop. And it's been going ever since. Because in that 10 years, the political forces, the socioeconomic forces, the realities of the world in Germany at the time created the perfect environment for the Reformation to start. Now, what do us Reformed people say that's because of? The answer, of course, is the sovereignty of God who purposed it all. So we're going to be talking next week, Lord willing, about this rethinking that gets us to this point. How did these men think differently? Luther, Melanchthon, the others. How did they think differently? What was the sum total of their theology? Not just justification by faith. That's not enough to get you to a place 10 years later where you have an entirely new branch of Christianity. That's not enough. There's going to be a whole lot more that's going to go into this. The Augsburg Confession isn't just one paragraph about justification by faith. It's a full confession of many things that you and I would utterly agree with. Some we don't, but much of which we would as Reformed folk in the 21st century. How do we get from the rethinking of that to that place? And that's where, to a place where you have the Reformation is, and that's why we need to talk about Luther's theology, and that's why Gonzalez has an entire chapter in his History of the Church on the theology of Luther. And I think he's right, because we need to know what that distinction is going to be. So, that will be our subject material for last week, for next week. But this week, I hope you see how important that decade was to creating the Reformed Church as it is. And if you really think about it, how easily it could have been destroyed. How easy it could have been toppled if only Francis I of France hadn't been such a pain in the side, or the Turks hadn't decided to attack, or Luther might not have made the decisions that he did in supporting the various movements or not supporting the various movements that were going on in Germany. Any of those things could have derailed this anywhere along the way. But here we are.